You're listening to the Two Tongues Podcast. And now your hosts, Kyle and Chris.
What is up, you guys? Welcome back, one and all, to another episode of the Two Tongues Podcast. Coming at you again with a little bit of opinion scholarship today. We're going to be talking about our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, you guys. All right, so the topic is Jesus today, with a little bit of a unique twist. I guess I'll begin by saying this episode wasn't inspired by a prior episode, but I think it's going to go along with it sort of serendipitously. So there was an episode I did last season called Parmenides the Shaman, and it was just sort of like kind of what we did with Carl Jung's Red Book episodes, where we were talking about what it means to be a shaman and how somebody like Carl Jung, some kind of academic psychologist, could find himself in that category. And with Parmenides and a number of the pre-Socratic Greeks, like Pythagoras and Empedocles and Parmenides and some of those, Orpheus even, there was a lot of interesting information about what we think about the roots of Western philosophy as rational as we like to think of that, as Aristotelian as we like to think of that, that in fact the beginnings of Greek philosophy were very mystical, and those sages, those early philosophers, were in fact shaman in the sense that we think about witch doctors and medicine men and Siberian shaman, you know, visionary experiences and primitive religious exercises. This is a theme. It's something that exists today in primitive tribes and you know, tribal people that live in a tribal way, sub-Saharan Africa and the Siberia and Australia and places like that. But also, it rests at the beginning of modern, you know, whatever you want to call them, civilized modern religions. The big ones that we think about, great monotheistic religions and Hinduism and Buddhism and all the others, that at the heart of them, at the beginning of them, is something like a mystical experience. It's something perhaps identical to what we hear from shaman. And the question then becomes, what about those religious figures that rest at the beginning of the major world religions? What about people like Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, people like Jesus of Nazareth? Were they shaman? Can we put them in the same category as we did with Parmenides and Orpheus and some of those people? And if we can, isn't that interesting? Doesn't it put a different spin on and make a different understanding of what a shaman means? Does that mean like a modern priest would qualify as a shaman? Something like that? I mean, have you thought about that before? Or is that one of those things that I'm not... I'm susceptible to as well, to think that there's such a big gulf between primitive religious exercises and experience and modern ones. Like, how can we call a modern religious prophet by the same word we're talking about primitive, very primitive Stone Age people even? You know, what might that mean? So there's some interesting stuff in here that I want to get to today. But I want to tell you where the inspiration actually came from this, because it wasn't, like I said, an intentional picking up where I left off from the episode on Parmenides. This was something kind of out of the blue. So I've said on a couple occasions that there's a number of sites and a number of Twitter follows that I are interesting, intriguing. One of those sites that will often post things that I find interesting is called ancientorigins.net, ancient-origins.net. If you're interested, it's one of these Twitter follows that I think is very interesting. A lot of that stuff is a little bit in the Graham Hancock camp, you know, I mean, a little bit of alternative history and some interesting things there, but a lot of interesting stuff about ancient history, which I love, so a good follow if you're interested. But there was an article that came across my feed. It's not a new one. I mean, it's a couple years old, actually. But it's talking about a new gospel or a holy text, not really a new gospel, but a holy text that was discovered in a ruined old monastery. And you know, it was translated and there were some surprises in it. It has to do with Jesus. And I don't want to lay it all out there because I want to kind of get to this slowly. I want to build the anticipation so you guys can enjoy the story. But this is where it started. And I dug around, did some research, and I was kind of blown away. I'm hoping that your mind will be blown as much as mine was. I don't want to put the cart too far in front of the horse here, but just understand this episode is going to be about Jesus, but it's going to take me a little while to get there. So where I want to begin is, well, this episode is called Jesus the Shaman. So what is a shaman? Let's talk about that for a second. When I think about a shaman, I think about a mystic, a priest, a healer, a prophet. You know, these are some words that come to my mind. So a shaman is somebody who, when I say a mystic, I mean somebody who participates, interacts with the spirit realm, somebody who is essentially a professional at that. That's what a shaman is. It's like the first professional priest. So a mystic, somebody who's interacting with the spiritual world, not just somebody who knows about it, somebody who actually interacts with it, somebody who's able to go into the spirit realm, who's able to actually interact with it. Also a priest, because these people were religious people. You might come to a shaman in the early days of humanity living in a tribal way, very close to nature. The shaman was a member of the community, but he was like the priest. So you would go to the shaman if you had a spiritual ailment, if you had a spiritual predicament. That was somebody who could talk you through it, somebody even who could help you to heal through from a psychic illness, spiritual illness, or even from a physical one. And of course, the word shaman comes from Siberia, and the native people that live there, again, very close to nature in a very primitive way, who maintain this kind of traditional holy man character, the shaman. But we see that same type of a character wherever we live like that, wherever human beings live in time or space, close to nature, in a tribal manner, the holy man takes the form of a shaman. So other words that you may have heard that mean something similar, witch doctor, medicine man, priest, prophet, all of these sorts of things. And you can think about tribal people from all over the world. I mentioned some of the usual suspects earlier, sub-Saharan African tribes, certain Native American tribes, especially those that are isolated, like in the Amazon and Siberia, that kind of thing, in Australia as well, and all over the place, really. And I think the important thing here is that a shaman is somebody who has learned to commune with the spirits and the spirit world, somebody who travels there. And I don't mean physically, obviously, somebody who travels there spiritually, and often they're doing that for seeking healing knowledge, right? How do I heal a sick person, either physically or spiritually? And by going into the spirit world, the shaman has access to information there from the spiritual forces and powers that are there that he doesn't have access to, he or she doesn't have access to in the sober waking world. But it's not just healing that they may find there. You know, maybe it's how to unlock some spiritual power. Maybe it's something like prophecy, foreseeing the future, what's going to be the outcome of the battle, whatever it might be. There's other information that exists in the spirit world that some sage with the necessary practice and training can access for the benefit of the community, to come back from that experience and share that with the community. So they partake in visionary experiences, and they come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. A lot of times those visionary experiences are achieved through starvation or fasting, you may call it, if it's intentional, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes there's just no food and somebody starves to the point where they're hallucinating or seeing visions. This is one path. Deprivation of other kinds, like sleep deprivation, is another common path. Ecstatic ritual is another. So working yourself up into a frenzy. Many tribal groups have extended periods of singing and dancing and chanting and all kinds of other things. Sometimes it involves you know, pain, for instance, you know, in one form or another. But you're working yourself up into a physical state where your mind dissociates for one reason or another, usually from exhaustion or pain or something. You have this dissociative experience, which is a altered state of consciousness. It can be a visionary experience. And then, of course, the use of psychoactive plants is another extremely common method to achieve something like that. And the idea is that the shaman sees the world in an unusual way. The shaman sees the world in a way that you do not. So you look out at a, you know, common scene there in front of your village or whatever, scene of nature and people and all the animals and whatever stuff you see every day. You look out and you see those things. You see tools and obstacles. You see, you know, practical things. Where a shaman looks out and sees those things, but layered over top of them or deeper within them, sees more, sees the spiritual forces and beings that flow alongside the physical material world. They see something else. So for them, the world is overlapped and imbued by these spiritual realities and forces that they know about, because they have these altered states of consciousness. They go into these visionary spiritual experiences. They have some proof that this stuff exists, and then it starts to kind of bleed into their sober reality. So they see perhaps a more complete representation of reality than ordinary sober people see. And of course, those visionary experiences involve altered states of consciousness where the shaman transforms, okay? You might think of an out-of-body experience because that's very common. Many shaman will talk about experiences of floating or you know, being free from their body. So there's all kinds of transformations that are seen, not to mention the way reality transforms in a visionary experience, a psychoactive, you know, drug experience as an example, where what's happening in front of you, the ordinary sober world, transforms into this amazing, fractal, geometrical, colorful reality, completely disconnected from anything you understand. It's like, what happened? How did reality transform into something like this, something completely strange and foreign and novel? Well, that's part and parcel to being a shaman. It has to do with, the experience has to do with being transformed, whether that be the shaman itself, the spirit of the shaman, the world around us, the whole kit and caboodle, you know, considered as one whole, that there's this transformation that takes place. The shaman becomes part of the flow of nature. He may become an animal, see through the eyes of an animal. He may become a god, a spirit. He may become another person. He may become the universe itself. And so what's interesting is that the shamanic experience involves something like shape-shifting. Right, so when we talked about some of those other words like witch doctor and medicine man, and I think most of us listening here understand this idea of shape shifting, we kind of associate with all of these sorts of categories: witch doctors, medicine men, shaman, shape shifting. Right. So I want to talk about shape shifting. I want to talk about how important that is, the relationship between shamanism and shape shifting. So to give you a little bit of a background here, some associations of shamanism and shape-shifting in mythology, in some of our oldest stories, and some of these cultural, foundational cultural components, things that you're going to find familiar, some you'll know, some you won't, but just to give you a quick list of some of these so you get some idea of how as much of this concept of shape-shifting seems like woo, and maybe you want to dismiss it. Maybe you want to do the same with shamanism, and I don't really blame you, especially if you haven't had a mystical or visionary experience of your own. But putting that aside, shape-shifting is something, plays a significant role in human culture and subtle ways and some very fundamental. So let me just go through a list of some of these with you. All right, so in folklore, most of us in the West and perhaps all over the world are familiar with characters like werewolves and vampires, right? So these are exciting, interesting stories we like to tell in folklore. What are they? You know, a wolf, a man who becomes a wolf, who transforms into a wolf, a man who transforms into a bat, right? Werewolves and vampires. Have you considered that even these characters are shapeshifters? And not just shapeshifters, they're therianthropes, which is interesting. That word therianthrope, I learned that from Graham Hancock. I was using other words, but when I heard him say that, I was like, oh, I like that better. Therion means like beast, wild beast in ancient Greek, and anthropos means man. So therianthropes are half man, half animal creatures, or creatures that can transform back and forth between a man and an animal. And so that's what we have with things like werewolves and vampires. And then while we're talking about those sorts of things, fairies, witches, wizards, those kind of things, are also noted for their ability to shapeshift. A witch, maybe she, you know, turns herself from an old hag into a beautiful woman, and you know, all these sorts of things. A good example of this from mythology is in the Odyssey. So, you know, the ancient Greek story. If you guys remember, there's a moment where Odysseus lands on an island, and I think it's Circe's island, and he goes in. She's a witch, you know. She's a goddess, but she's sort of like a witch, and she turns all of his men into pigs. If you remember that, so even in some of our earliest myths, you have this magical creature, this woman, this witch, who's able to shift shapes. Right? She takes Odysseus's men and turns them into pigs. Now, while we're talking about fairies and witches and things like that, one thing I've talked about before when it comes to fairy tales, because I've been getting into that a bit, is this idea of a changeling, right? This comes up a bit. It's one of these stories associated with fairies that your child may be stolen away by a fairy and replaced by a fake, right? By a changeling, something that looks like your child but isn't your child. And so this idea of changelings and face changers, this is something that you'll see in fairy stories. Also in Game of Thrones, I don't know if you guys remember the faceless men in Game of Thrones. This also comes to my mind as kind of a modern adaptation. All right, a couple of others. In the Caribbean, where we have a lot of black magic and voodoo and things like that, there is a traditional story of the Ligahoo. The Ligahoo in Trinidad and Tobago is a shapeshifter. And it's associated with the practice of that type of voodoo shamanism, you know, that African shamanism, essentially. And then, of course, the skinwalker. Many of you guys, because this has been popular in pop culture, and there's, you know, television shows about it now, the skinwalker is from Native American mythology, specifically Navajo mythology, is a creature associated with shamanism, right? Just like the Ligahoo of the Caribbean. But in this case, Native American version, the skinwalker is associated with shamanism, associated with a man transforming into an animal. I believe that's very, very common trope with the skinwalker is sort of like witnessing something like a man suddenly transform into an animal walking on four legs, that kind of thing. And the list goes on and on. I mean, in Slavic mythology, one of the main gods, Veles, was a shape-shifting god, also associated with animals and magic and the underworld and things like that. He transforms into a bear or a wolf or what have you. Maui, in the Polynesian mythology, for those of you who are Disney fans or maybe you're Hawaiian or something and you're familiar, Maui was a cultural hero in Polynesia, kind of like a Hercules-type character, and he's a shapeshifter, right? He changes shape from man to animal and so forth. Similarly, in Japan, we have the obake, which are shape-shifting spirits that turn into foxes and spirits of nature. If we go up to the frigid north, we go up to the Norse area, you have the god Loki, who's notoriously a shaman and a shapeshifter, right? He turns into a salmon or a flea or a bear or other humans or whatever it is. And we see the same, you know, with like in the Greek religion with Proteus and even Zeus, but with Proteus, the idea of with Proteus is that he could tell the future. And people try to get him to tell the future. And in the stories, he finds a way out of it. Like he doesn't want to. He finds a way out of it by shifting his shape, by pretending that he's not who he's, you know, who he is. And we see the same with the king of the gods in the ancient Greek religion, with Zeus himself. If you guys remember, Zeus became a swan or a bull. Remember when he had to go out and seduce the princess Europa, he turns himself into a bull. So we see this deeply. We see this everywhere in the West, you know, in the old world and in the new world. We see it in primitive cultures and more sophisticated ones. In fact, this idea of shape-shifting, we see it in the oldest forms of religion, like shamanism and totemism and some of these things that we're talking about, primitive tribal people, adhering to. But even in our oldest stories, you know, we talked about the Odyssey, but in the Iliad and the Epic of Gilgamesh, you see elements of shape-shifting, you know, all the way back then. In ancient Turkey, there's specifically legends of shaman, and they're specifically shaman, right? Ancient holy people called kurtadams, or wolfmen, and they're form-changing, you know, shape-shifting shamans. The ancient Greeks actually had a word, kynanthropy, which is the ability to change between animal and human form, or something like that. Right? They had a name for it. If you think about like the gods of Egypt as an example, you know, oftentimes with characteristics of animals and humans, you kind of see this flow from primitive shamanism all the way up to the classical world, and the Greeks and the Egyptians and the Sumerians and all that. And again, I'll remind you that those early Greek philosophers, Orpheus and Pythagoras and all those, even Plato himself took part in the Eleusinian mysteries. Even Plato himself had this vein of mysticism in his history. And so these early, even Greek philosophers were very much in the vein of a shaman. And while we're talking about shape-shifting, and we're seeing that in our oldest religions, and we're seeing it pop up in our oldest stories, we actually have evidence of shape-shifting in human culture predating all of that. Our oldest stories and our oldest writing. What do I mean by that? What predates our oldest stories? Well, in archaeological sites, like in Les Trois Frères, the Three Brothers Cave in France, and Lascaux in France, and Spain and other places as well. We have these Stone Age Paleolithic caves. They call them the Painted Caves, places like Altamira and some others, where they're covered with these prehistoric paintings and carvings. And in France in particular, we have this image called the Sorcerer of Les Trois Frères. We have the Birdman of Lascaux, and these are what look like, I'm staring at pictures of them right now, they are what look like a man transforming midway, like him in the midst of transformation. A man transforming into an animal, or even multiple animals that has features of multiple animals all at once, as is the case with the sorcerer. And so some of these cave paintings are 30,000 years old. So that's what I mean when they say they predate even our oldest stories. And we have these amazing images of shape-shifting going on in a religious context. And what's interesting is that a lot of scholars who study these cave paintings, they look at these shape-shifting creatures, these therianthrope images that I'm talking about, and they don't believe that these pictures are supposed to represent like a mythical beast, like a griffin or a sphinx or something like that. That they're not supposed to represent a mythical creature. But instead, they're representations of a shaman in the process of communing with the spirits. a shaman in the process of communing with nature. And the image of that, the internal experience of that, if you had it yourself and then you were trying to, you know, paint it on a wall, it would be something like this: a man in the midst of this wishy-washy mixing with nature and animal characteristics. It's like the spirit of man swimming in the greater soup, spirits of all kinds, of all of nature, you know, and swirling around in that. And this representation is this shape-shifting sort of half-animal, half-man image. And it's one of the oldest religious images that we have. So there's this link between shamanism, our earliest forms of religion and religious experience, and shape-shifting. But this episode today is about Jesus. So what am I doing here? Why am I talking all about shamanism and shape-shifting if I'm supposed to be talking about Jesus? So that brings me to a question that I kind of posed a little bit earlier at the beginning. Was Jesus a shaman? We know Jesus was this holy man and this religious character and so forth, prophet. But was he a shaman? Now, the line on that maybe is a little bit, and hopefully by this point you realize is a little bit foggier. That line is a little bit less hard than you might imagine. The line between a modern religious figure and a shaman, which we may associate with these more primitive periods of time or more primitive cultures or whatever, there really is kind of a gray area there that separates them. That brings me to an interesting archaeological discovery. This is what that article, ancientorigins.net article from a few years ago, was talking about. A document that was found along with others, along with like a whole library of 50 other documents. But this one is called Homily on the Life and Passion of Christ. This is the particular document I want to talk about. It was found buried in like a stone vase or something. And it was intentionally buried for safekeeping, like what we saw with the Nag Hammadi Library or the Dead Sea Scrolls. But in this case, it was actually buried in a monastery in Egypt. It's called the Monastery of the Archangel Michael of the Desert, near a place called Al-Humuli in Egypt. Now, this monastery had been around a long time, but it hadn't actually been in use since 1000 AD. So it's an ancient monastery, but it's basically a ruin. All right, so fast forward to about 1910. This stone vase buried in the desert there, in the ruins of this monastery, is discovered. And there's all these documents. There's like 50 documents in there. They're all written in Coptic, in this ancient Egyptian language. In fact, some of the oldest Christian churches in the world are Egyptian, and they're Coptic. So this is a very exciting discovery. And this library was immediately bought up by J.P. Morgan, one of the richest men on earth. He buys this up and puts it in his collection. And in fact, this document still exists in the J.P. Morgan library. It wasn't actually translated. Remember, it was discovered in 1910, and it wasn't translated until 2013. So not all that long ago. Turns out this document dates to around 800 AD, like I said, written in Coptic, and it was attributed to an important theologian, early church theologian, and saint named Cyril of Jerusalem. So Cyril of Jerusalem supposedly had written this homily on the life and passion of Christ. Saint Cyril himself lived like in the 300s AD, and he was an important early church theologian. He was a bishop, the Bishop of Jerusalem. And he wrote a bunch of things like this. He wrote a bunch of things. And some of them are controversial. It's not clear whether he really wrote them, like they're attributed to him, but did he really write them? I don't know. In this case, it's probably unlikely that St. Cyril actually wrote this particular document, the Homily on the Life and Passion of Christ, but just know it was attributed to him, and he wrote lots of things like this. And so far, there's only been one limited publication of this Homily on the Life and Passion of Christ. It was done by a professor, Rolf van der Broek, from the Netherlands. He actually published a book called Pseudo Cyril of Jerusalem on the Life and Passion of Christ. And that book is extremely expensive. If you can find it, it's like $200. So, you know, you decide whether you how interested you are in maybe reading more. But just know, there's very limited translations so far of this text. And it's interesting, like a lot of these Gnostic texts that were discovered, it says interesting things or has stories that are very unusual. So you guys may remember some of the Gnostic books that were discovered had stories in them about, like there's these infancy gospels as an example. They were written long after Jesus died, so you know, there's probably not a lot of truth in them, but they have interesting stories about Jesus making pigeons or doves or whatever out of clay and breathing life into them, and they were flying away. And he was doing that on the Sabbath, right? And his friends see him, and they're like, yeah, you're not allowed to do work on the Sabbath. We're going to tell on you. And Jesus ends up killing this kid. Like, he pushes this kid off a building or something. And when he gets in trouble for it, he just, like, raises the kid back from the dead, and it's like, no harm, no foul. These kind of weird stories that you see in some of these apocryphal books that you don't see in the canonical ones, we have some stuff like this happening. So as an example, in this one, Pontius Pilate is described as being a supporter of Christ, maybe even a disciple of Christ, right? Isn't that interesting? And he actually tries to save Jesus from being crucified. He even offers his own son in place of Jesus. This is the way they spin the Pontius Pilate story in this particular story. Very unusual, right? Very interesting. Kind of reminds me of like the Gospel of Judas, if you guys remember that one, or the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, where if we look at the Gospel of Judas, I mean, we think of Judas traditionally, canonically, as the villain. He's like the, he's the, what's that guy's name? Benedict, Jesus, I can't think of from American history. The guy that was a, damn it. You know what I mean? Benedict Arnold. That's the guy. He's something like that. He's like a, kind of a double agent playing both sides of the aisle, and you know, might have had a respectable place in history, but instead threw it all away. And so we talk about that with Benedict Arnold in the very similar ways to Judas. But in the Gospel of Judas, it flips it on its head, and now suddenly Judas is the hero, and Jesus has a secret agreement with them. It's like, hey, I have to be crucified and in order to be resurrected, and so I need you to help me get crucified. So I need you to come kiss me in front of the Romans, identify me, make sure I get crucified, because it has to happen, right? So the Gospel of Judas spins the story to make Judas out to be the hero. And so this is the kind of thing we see here. We also hear in this newly discovered homily on the life and passion of Christ, we also have this interesting idea that Jesus had the magical ability to shapeshift. Isn't that interesting? Jesus was a shapeshifter. And he, and even better, in this story, Judas has to kiss Jesus to identify who he is, because it's not reliable to describe what Jesus looks like. You can't say, okay, Romans, if you want to find Jesus, go find a guy who looks like this. He's so tall, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, that was unreliable. You couldn't identify Jesus by his appearance because he was a shapeshifter, right? So Judas had to kiss him in front of the Romans, right, to identify who the right person is that was the criminal. And so this is the story that's told. These are the interesting little spins. And here's the quote directly from the homily on the life and passion of Christ that I want to read to you. And it goes like this. Then the Jews said to Judas, "How shall we arrest him? For he does not have a single shape, but his appearance changes. Sometimes he is ruddy, sometimes he is white. Sometimes he is red, sometimes he is wheat colored. Sometimes he is pallid like ascetics. Sometimes he's a youth, sometimes an old man." All right, so this quote comes right out of the homily, right out of this newly discovered document. And it says, how are we supposed to arrest Jesus? He doesn't have a single shape, but his appearance changes. So Jesus is a shapeshifter. All right, so you might want to just say, okay, look, at the oldest, this story is, you know, 400 years after Jesus died. It's probably even later than that, but let's just say, you know, it dates back to the time of Cyril of Jerusalem. Maybe it's 400 AD or something like that. Well, that's a long time after the time of Jesus. So can we just dismiss this as some kind of, just like we did with a story about Jesus making the doves out of clay and killing the kid and all that, just like the story of Judas being the hero, can we brush all this aside and say, these are apocryphal stories that are much later developments that we don't have to take these seriously. These aren't canonical in any way. Jesus wasn't a shapeshifter. This is just something that, you know, some weird person said once upon a time in some small, you know, small church in Egypt, and it's, you know, unimportant. Can we? So my instinct was to think, yeah, probably. This is silly. Yeah. However, there's more. So the question is there earlier evidence that Jesus was a shapeshifter? Is there earlier evidence than the homily on the life and passion of Christ that maybe dates to the 400s AD? Turns out there is. So one of the very important early church writers, theologians, is named Origen of Alexandria. And he has lots of things that he wrote. Very famous church father. And he talks about the explanation for Judas's kiss, just like St. Cyril did. He talks about exactly this. Now, he lived 185 AD to 245, so much, much earlier, much closer to the time of Jesus. And he wrote a book called Contra Celsum. And chapter 64, book 2, there's a quote here I want to read to you. Origen says, although Jesus was only a single individual, he was nevertheless more things than one. Nor was he seen in the same way by all who beheld him. He did not appear in like fashion to all those who saw him, but according to their ability to receive him. This is why, when he was about to be transfigured, he did not admit all his apostles, only Peter and James and John, because they alone were capable of beholding his glory on that occasion. And the following statement shows that he had not always the same appearance, that Judas, when about to betray him, said to the multitudes, as if they weren't acquainted with Jesus, quote, whosoever I shall kiss, the same is he. Right? And Jesus himself seems to indicate the same in the words, quote, I was daily with you, teaching in the temple, and you laid no hold on me. And Origen says, the transfiguration of his body, which took place when and to whom he would. Right? So this idea of Jesus's being able to transfigure his body, like what we saw when he ascended to heaven, let's say, that this was something that he didn't just do when he ascended to heaven, but could do, you know, whenever he wanted. And this also explains why Judas had to kiss Jesus, because he could transfigure his body. Isn't that interesting? So St. Cyril, 400 AD, Origen of Alexandria, 200 AD. So this makes me wonder if Origen was saying exactly what St. Cyril was suggesting. Is there evidence even earlier? Is there evidence in the Bible that Jesus was a shapeshifter? Okay, remember, the Gospels were written between about 40 and just over 100 AD. Is there evidence there, right there, you know, right after the time of Jesus' death, that he was a shapeshifter? I don't know what you might think, but the answer is yes. Okay, let me just read some of these to you. Gospel of Mark, chapter 16, to set the stage. We're at the empty tomb, right? Jesus is no longer, he's been killed, placed in the tomb. Now we're at the tomb where his body should be, and it's empty. And the Gospel of Mark says, "Now when Jesus was risen, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, and she went and told him that had been with him," "and she went and told them that had been with him as they mourned and wept. And when they heard he was alive and had been seen of her, believed not. After that, he appeared in another form unto two of them as they walked and went into the country." Okay, so at the tomb, nobody, there's nobody there. Mary Magdalene is there. She sees Jesus. She goes and tells everybody else, "You're not going to believe it. I went to the tomb. Jesus is gone. And he was there living, and I spoke to him." And what does the scripture say in Mark? They believed her not. So nobody believed her. But then it says, after that, he appeared in another form unto two of them. It's not just that Jesus appeared to two other apostles. It's that he appeared in another form. Okay, well, that's just one. Are there others? Let's go to chapter 24 of Luke, again, at the empty tomb. And Luke goes like this. "And behold, two of them went the same day to a village called Emmaus, and they talked together of these things which had happened. And while they communed together, Jesus himself drew near and went with them. But their eyes were holden that they should not know him. And he said, What manner of communications are these that ye are sad? And one of them said, Art thou only a stranger in Jerusalem, and hast not known the things which are come to pass there? And they drew near unto a village, whither they went. And he made as though he would have gone further, but they constrained him, saying, Abide with us, for it is towards evening, and the day is far spent. And he went in to tarry with them, and he sat with them. He took bread and blessed it, and gave it to them. And their eyes were opened, and they knew him, and he vanished out of their sight." All right, so let me rewind here to this bit where it says, they're walking to Emmaus, a couple of apostles are walking to Emmaus, and then some stranger on the journey appears with them and walks with them. And it says, while they communed together, Jesus himself drew near and went with them. Here's the good part. But their eyes were holden that they should not know him. Okay, what does that mean in King James Version? Let's make that modern English. Their eyes were kept from recognizing him. Right? They're walking to Emmaus. A stranger shows up. It's Jesus, but they don't know it's Jesus. They don't know it's Jesus until they invite him in to stay with the night with them, and they break bread together. And as soon as Jesus breaks the bread and passes it to them, it says their eyes were opened and they knew him. And then he vanished out of their sight. So the moment he breaks the bread, blesses the bread, and hands it to them, suddenly this person who they were certain was a stranger and not Jesus, suddenly they recognize it is Jesus. And poof, he's gone. So we have one in Mark, we have one in Luke. Are there others? Well, let's go to John for a second. Let's go to chapter 20 of the Gospel of John. And here we have Mary, again at the empty tomb. And John 20 goes like this. "She saw Jesus standing, and knew not that it was Jesus. Jesus said unto her, Woman, why weepest thou? Whom seekest thou? She, supposing him to be a gardener, said unto him, Sir, if thou have borne him away hence, tell me where thou hast laid him, and I will take him away. Jesus said unto her, Mary. She turned herself and said unto him, Master." Again, you have Mary speaking with Jesus, thinking he is a stranger. And when Jesus says to her, Mary, suddenly it's like a veil is lifted and she recognizes she's speaking to Jesus. Let's hop one chapter forward in John for a second. Let's go to John chapter 21. And this is literally Jesus appearing to his disciples after the resurrection. That's where we are in the story. And it goes like this. After these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. Simon Peter said unto them, I go fishing. They say unto him, we also go with thee. They went forth and entered into a ship, and that night they caught nothing. But when the morning was come, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples knew not that it was Jesus. Then Jesus said unto them, Children, have ye any meat? They answered him, No. And he said unto them, Cast the net on the right side of the ship, and ye shall find. They cast therefore, and now they were not able to draw it for the multitude of fishes. Therefore that disciple saith unto Peter, It is the Lord. Okay, now then they return to land, and they begin preparing the fish that they just got, this giant, giant haul of fish. And it picks up like this. Jesus said unto them, Come and dine. And none of the disciples dared ask him, Who art thou? Knowing that it was the Lord. All right, so Jesus, who had appeared with the apostles, who went fishing with them because they needed to eat, of course, and they, of course, catch nothing. In the morning, Jesus is not on the boat. He's somewhere else, you know, in the shore, wherever they can see him, obviously. And he tells them to cast the net on the other side. And at that point, when they're pulling in all these fish, Peter is suspicious that this is Jesus, right? But nobody says it is. But after the ship returns to shore and they're cooking all of the fish, and Jesus says, Come and dine. Specifically, it says none of the disciples dared ask him who he was because they knew that it was Jesus. So what do you think? Jesus was a shapeshifter. We know he's a holy man. We know holy people with the power of shapeshifting are shamans. You know, they're this classical, primordial priest type character. So what do you think? Was Jesus a shaman? Was he a shapeshifter? Incredibly, there seems to be evidence for both. Jesus, like a traditional shaman, was a holy man and a healer and a prophet. He checks absolutely all of the boxes on the shamanic rubric. Even the visionary quests can be found in Jesus' life. At his baptism, he sees the Holy Spirit descend upon him in the form of a dove, and he hears the voice of God, right? He's shown visions by the devil in the desert when he's being tempted, right? So all of this begs the question, what is the difference between a prophet in modern religious terms and a shaman? We're perhaps biased to think of shamanism as a uniquely tribal phenomena, something primitive in comparison to modern religion. But this is a mistake. Far from being a detractor from its authenticity, the word primitive may actually be a strength here. This is because religious experience, in the deepest sense, is primitive. It is something innate, something like a human instinct. The quest for the divine is something unconscious within us and yet guides us in our values and our striving and our moral judgments. It could be argued, in fact, that when what we call sophisticated or civilized in modern religion, you know, things like ritual, mythology, dogma, the construction of churches and cathedrals and burning incense and all these sorts of things, that they're distractors from the religious instinct within us. These things can pull us out and away from ourselves, pulling our attention toward the objective world, you know, toward the spires of the church and the beauty of the stained glass, the crowd of believers standing all around you. In such a setting, attention to the spiritual can be lost. We get caught up in the representation rather than having an intimate, personal experience of what is being represented, you know? The shaman, on the contrary, goes within himself to reach the spiritual realm. No assistance can be found for him in the objective world. Not where he's going. His attention is pulled within, concentrated on the immaterial and the numinous. Here the shaman enters the Godhead. You might ask how a shaman can learn how to heal through a vision or learn what the future holds. Clearly, such information can't be found in the world out there. So how is it that it can be found within somehow? The answer is mystical. It relies on the shamanic view that all of reality is ultimately a divine unity. The shaman and the mystics say that all is one. And their quest into spirit or something like a conscious participation in that unity. Stated differently, when a shaman enters the spirit realm, he becomes one with the cosmos and with God. In that state, he is boundless. He's no longer suppressed by natural barriers and human limitations, not even by space or time. He becomes the all and therefore knows all. How to heal your intractable illness, even what shall come to be. So what about this mystical unity? If such is the hallmark of the shaman, can we find this too in Jesus? In fact, we can. And it's far more obvious than you might think. In the Gospel of John, for instance, Jesus prays to God, asking for humanity, quote, that they all may be one as thou, Father, art in me and I in thee, that they also may be one in us.
Well, there you have it. That's one avenue explored, but infinitely more still to go. I hope you enjoyed thinking along with us. I know. It's not easy work. Thinking. It's hard and full of uncertainties, but I'm grateful for the company as we trek through this together. Here's to hoping that the juice is worth the squeeze. See what I did there? Let's find out together in the next episode.